So continuing on with this chapter 15 in this book, and is the last sutta that our point or that was what was made is sort of in the nature of the establishing the mind with that perception of Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming, and this is a really worthy mantra to sort of work on or sort of challenge the mind with. And it really helps to stop the mind. Okay, further. Those who have been liberated know that more work for the freeing of the mind is not necessary. And I've got two quotes, and one from Anguttara 8, number 30, when it's that's the first one is very familiar to everyone, but both quotes show how the freed mind is no longer in need of striving or a feeling of a sense of lack. And the second quote is from Samyutta 2, Sutta number 5, which those early suttas in the Samyutta Nikaya are conversations that the Buddha has with devas and devatas. Okay. First one from Anguttara. He knew birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is nothing further for the sake of this world. So that just sets that clarity of recognizing that, yeah, the work is done. There is an end to this, this practice and holy life. And the next one from Samyutta 2, number 5. At Savati, then when the night had advanced, the young Deva Dhamali, of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jetas Grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and recited this verse in the presence of the Blessed One. This should be done by the Brahman, and Brahman meaning a religious seeker. This should be done by the Brahman, striving without weariness, that by his abandoning of sensual desires, he does not yearn for existence. And then the Buddha kind of replies to him, for the Brahman, there is no task to be done, O Dhamali, said the Blessed One. For the Brahman has done what should be done. While he has not gained a footing in the river, a man will strain with all his limbs, but a footing gained, standing on the ground, he need not strain, for he has gone beyond. This is a simile for the Brahman, O Dhamali, for the taintless one, the discreet meditator, having reached the end of birth and death, need not strain, for he has gone beyond. Still, those who have followed the path to the end find that spiritual qualities that were developed along the path are still available to them. And this is a quote from Anguttara 3, Sutta number 83. Then afterwards, that monk trained in the higher virtue, in the higher mind, in the training of the higher wisdom. As he so trained, he abandoned lust, hatred, and delusion. With their abandoning, he did not do anything unwholesome or resort to anything evil. So there is a, there isn't a, say with that, say the result of the training is that one is freed from greed, hatred, and delusion, and the one doesn't, isn't pulled or drawn toward the unskillful or the unwholesome. It's just is a part of the package. One doesn't need to sort of force oneself to be a good Buddhist after some kind of liberation. Yeah, that's it's just is it is there. And another example, Sunyutta 52, Sutta number 9. And this is involving Aniruddha, who is a cousin of the Buddha's, who is fully awakened. And was the foremost in knowing other worlds. Wasn't that it?
Yes.
Yeah, he's sort of foremost in knowing other worlds. He was
The
a
deeper chakra.
Dīpa Chakhu. He was a bit of a space cadet. And he wasn't particularly practical. There's this wonderful quote where he Ananda is complaining to the Buddha about Aniruddha's disciples making trouble for the Sangha, and Aniruddha not dealing with it, and he's complaining to the Buddha, and Ananda said, "And when did Aniruddha ever deal with stuff like that?" So.
Also, he has Pachitya rule made on account of him.
Right. Anyway, this is not, this is nothing, this is very noble what's happening in this next sutta. Okay, friend Aniruddha, your faculties are serene, your complexion is pure and bright. In what dwelling does the venerable Aniruddha now usually dwell? Now, friend, I usually dwell with a mind well established in the four establishments of mindfulness. The bhikkhu friend who is an arahant, one whose taints are destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached his own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, one completely liberated through final knowledge, usually dwells with a mind well established in these four establishments of mindfulness. Yeah, again, this just to me, it's a. Since that the training or the fruits of the training continue into the life that they that an awakened being lives. Any questions? Yeah.
Yeah, I said, remember you're talking about this idea that an arahant knows for definite, oh yeah, that's birth destroyed. I seem to remember reading in Stillness Realm, I think, that there's a comment that when Ajahn Chah, reached full liberation, he waited 2 years just to be sure. Is that
Could be, could be, could be. I'm not. Could be. I have a vague recollection as well. Yeah, but because sometimes there's any number of accounts of monks who are absolutely and completely totally convinced of their awakening. They're completely off their rockers. That's they're really dangerous because they're really convinced, and oftentimes go out seeking followers as well. So it's yeah, Ajahn Chah's temperament is such, he's very, very circumspect.
I think it was in the languaging of it was that he made a point of testing himself. Just like really saying, okay, is there really anything that the mind is clinging to at all, and had that kind of scrutiny, and so that he was just what like Dailan Paul Prasanna was saying, just wanting to make sure. Anyway, not because of an internal doubt, but just that wanting to confirm his understanding and just checking, and to do with things like physical pain or challenging situations and such things, to say, okay, is anything moving there? Is anybody here? And that I had that similar, that after a couple of years, he thought, okay, there's nothing here and nothing is moving. So, But he was very, very reticent. Again, Lumpur was with him much more than I was, but he was very, very reticent to talk in terms of attainment and wouldn't make much of that. And he could see this how people would just get kind of drunk and deluded on those ideas or aiming for those things. So he would play it down. And as you have in this different Dhamma books of his or collected teachings, when people would ask him, you know, are you enlightened? Or he's like, don't ask whether I am, ask why you're not. And I think the most he ever said was that example about I'm like an old tree and the birds come and land in the branches and some say he's enlightened and some of the other birds say he's not enlightened. It's, to me, that's just the chattering of the birds. That's about as much as you get. This is, as I recall.
Yeah, no, Ajahn Chah was very, very circumspect in terms of the... because, you know, people get really, really weird and, you know, infatuated or enthralled by attainment. And whether it's attainment of Nibbana or whether it's the jhanas or knowledge of different realms of existence and whatnot, there it spins off into real there are a lot of strangenesses that Ajahn Chah was really, you know, very circumspect and really bringing things back to experience, Four Noble Truths, anicca, dukkha, anatta, letting go. It's just that endless refrain, you know, it's quite wonderful to witness, really, because he didn't have to, you know, people are just sort of waiting to make something special of him, he was quite adamant to not. You know, it's just people. I mean, his duty was to try to teach people Dhamma, as opposed to be something for anybody. Yeah.
You talked about the end of striving, the end of straining, the end of forcing. Just now, and then yesterday you were talking about standing on one side, neither straining nor holding back.
Yep.
And it just seems to be a bit of a paradox there. Do we strain now and stop when we get there?
Well, you've got to do something. I mean, a lot of it is. I mean, the you know, how do you find a middle way, and sometimes that middle way is you've got to put some effort in. You have to be willing to experiment. You have to be willing to not, because we tend to be reticent and out of fear or just laziness. I don't know about anybody else, but I can be lazy. How do we find that sort of middle way? And sometimes you have to experiment and see. So, you know, on the outside it might look like too much relaxing or too much striving. But it's sort of like it's being the main thing is that it's being reflected on and investigated what works, what doesn't work, what's the result of this, what's the benefit, what's the drawback.
there's places where the Buddha says, having reached a certain level, don't be content. Yes.
Yeah.
don't rest, don't stop there. You know, so like, oh, I thought we were supposed to be, it was all about stopping. Well, yes and no.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things there's two qualities that the Buddha attributes to his full awakening, and one is the, you know, that not being content with what he's realized and gained, and striving, effort, putting forth effort. Yeah.
A question further to your point, what you were just explaining about Ajahn Chah. How did the Buddha deal with this issue of people becoming enlightened and contemporaneous with him? Because there were, were there others who became, it sounds like there were.
Oh, yeah.
How did he deal with this issue of people getting a little bit... a little bit crazy, and especially in that time, his contemporaries who were not in the Dharma also had cities, also had practice, and showed, certain qualities that, again, how did he distinguish between the non-Buddhists and their cities and the Buddhists and their attainments?
Yeah, well, the attainments are especially for what the Buddha was very... much focused on is the freedom from greed, hatred, delusion, freedom from suffering. So that the various cities and psychic powers and abilities that are possible, those are all laid out, mapped out quite clearly. Yeah, this is possible for anybody who trains the mind. It's not unheard of. So that the Buddha is, what he's trying to get people to do is to move the heart toward that relinquishment of attachment and clinging and freedom from suffering, and that's much of it is around the sense of self. In terms of how can one quantify it and set that sense of that relinquishment of I and being becoming, that bhava tanha. So those are and I couldn't tell you where the sutta is, but there's a sutta where the Buddha says in declaring knowledge, like full knowledge, awakened knowledge, a proper declaration of full knowledge does not include a sense of me and my.
And he's usually fairly brief in talking about other people that they say they're not an arahant and they're not on the path. So arahantship, full stop, and sometimes he would make the effort to go and visit different groups or different teachers, and he'd sort of just show up at their camp or where they're teaching and engage in order to help establish them in right view, his vision, his own sense of where people were at was extremely reliable.
No.
So that he could assess clearly and directly where other beings were at.
Yeah, it was one of his kind of realizations or powers of a fully awakened one. Also, I think one of the things that is telling, in taking on somebody for ordination. From another tradition or another practice lineage, the bottom line of acceptance was not what attainment they realized or what they had seen, but their acceptance of the law of karma, so that is a major piece of right view.
I was trying to imagine what would be to look into the world through the eyes of an arahant. I imagine something like looking at through the matrix, not being illuded or with the passion, like looking at people in the, like looking at children.
Children's game.
Is there something in the suttas regarding
the
youth?
Not really. What comes to mind is not a sutta quote, but there's a what comes to mind is a a question that somebody asked Lungta Mahabur, who is widely revered as an arhat, and he was asked, "What is the mind of an arhat like?" And his And he just sort of, only compassion. It was really, really beautiful. It wasn't a long explanation of some sort of knowledge or whatnot, but that you know, really cutting to the chase. Only compassion. And, you know, I think my experience of living with Ajahn Chah, I would say that sense of compassion was his. His form of compassion could be pretty demanding sometimes, but it was I never ever, and none of us that really were close to him never ever felt anything other than his concern and compassion and sometimes he could be quite demanding, but it was more like, you can do this, just stop messing about.
like the chief consultant in charge of the psychiatric hospital. What did they do? They did what today?
And it was just endless, boundless kind of patience with being, which didn't mean he didn't get exasperated sometimes, but it was always this humor around it. So, I can't believe what they imagine that, what the monks or the novices were up to again today. Yeah.
In the passage you read yesterday, that one adjective, the from the point of view of an awakened person, the five aggregates come across as feeble, is pretty telling. So what drives the whole world? Feeble is the assessment of an arahant. It's like,
Just, it's not that compelling. We're sort of going through a variety of qualities. In a discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, Venerable Ananda recounts all the many wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Buddha. He begins with the Buddha's dwelling in Dusita heaven as a bodhisattva immediately prior to this lifetime and the many aspects of his miraculous conception and birth. The Buddha approves of what Ananda has said, but concludes by saying, and this is Majjhima 123, which is...
Wonderful and marvelous.
The wonderful and marvelous sutta. I didn't write down the Pali. And that being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Here, Ananda, for the Tathagata, feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Remember this too, Ananda, as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. So that it's brought back into the realm of the practical very quickly. And I thought I would read that sutta because it's
wonderful and marvelous.
It's wonderful and marvelous. And Acharya Abhuta. Thus have I heard. This is Machima 123. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sahavati in Jetis Grove, Anatta Pindika's park. Now, a number of bhikkhus were sitting in the assembly hall where they had met together on returning from their alms round after the meal, when this discussion arose among them. It is wonderful, friends, it is marvelous, how mighty and powerful is the Tathagata, for he is able to know about the Buddhas of the past, who attained to final Nibbana, cut the tangle of proliferation, broke the cycle, ended the round, and surmounted all suffering, that for those blessed ones, their birth was thus, their names were thus, their clans were thus, their virtue was thus, their state of concentration was thus, their wisdom was thus, their abiding in attainments was thus, their deliverance was thus. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda told the bhikkhus, friends, Tathagatas are wonderful and have wonderful qualities. Tathagatas are marvelous and have marvelous qualities. However, their discussion was interrupted, for the Blessed One rose from meditation when it was evening, went to the assembly hall, and sat down on a seat made ready. Then he addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus, for what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted? Here, Venerable Sir, we were sitting in the assembly hall where we had met together on returning from our alms round after our meal when this discussion arose among us. It is wonderful, it is marvelous, and their deliverance was thus. When this was said, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda said to us, friends, Tathagatas are wonderful and have wonderful qualities. Tathagatas are marvelous and have marvelous qualities. This was our discussion, Venerable Sir, that was interrupted when the Blessed One arrived. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda. That being so, Ananda, explain more fully the Tathagata's wonderful and marvelous qualities. I heard and learned this, Venerable Sir, from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, Ananda, the Bodhisattva appeared in the Tusita heaven. That mindful and fully aware, the Buddha, Bodhisattva appeared in the Tusita heaven, this I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva remained in the Tusita heaven. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. For the whole of his lifespan, the Bodhisattva remained in the Tusita heaven. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared in the world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas. In this generation, with its recluses and Brahmins, with its princes and its people, and even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendor of the gods, appeared. And beings reborn there perceived each other by that light. So indeed, sir, there are other beings reborn here. And this 10,000-fold world system shook and quaked and trembled, and there too a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, four young deities came to guard him at the four quarters, so that no humans or non-humans or anyone at all could harm the Bodhisattva or his mother. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she became intrinsically virtuous, refraining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech, and from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, which are the basis of negligence. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no sensual thought arose in her concerning men, and she was inaccessible to any man having a lustful mind. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she obtained the five cords of sensual pleasure, and furnished and endowed with them, she enjoyed herself with them. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, no kind of affliction arose in her. She was blissful and free from bodily fatigue. She saw the Bodhisattva within her womb with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. Suppose a blue, yellow, red, white, or brown thread were strung through a fine beryl gem of purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut, and a man with good sight were to take it in his hand and review it thus. This is a fine beryl gem of purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut, and through it is strung a blue, yellow, red, white, or brown thread. So too, when the Bodhisattva had descended into his mother's womb, she saw the Bodhisattva within her womb with all his limbs, lacking no faculty. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. 7 days after the birth of the Bodhisattva, his mother died and reappeared in the Tusita heaven. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women gave birth after carrying the child in the womb for 9 or 10 months, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth to him after carrying him in her womb for exactly 10 months. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Other women give birth seated or lying down, but not so the Bodhisattva's mother. The Bodhisattva's mother gave birth to him standing up. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, first gods received him, then human beings. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he did not touch the earth. The four young gods received him and set him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O Queen, a son of great power has been born to you." This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, he came forth unsullied, unsmeared by water or humans or blood or any kind of impurity, clean and unsullied. Suppose there were a gem placed upon kasi cloth. Then the gem would not smear the cloth or the cloth the gem. Why is that? Because of the purity of both. So too, when the Bodhisattva came forth, clean and unsullied. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, two jets of water appeared to pour from the sky, one cool and one warm, for bathing the Bodhisattva and his mother. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. As soon as the Bodhisattva was born, he stood firmly with his feet on the ground. Then he took seven steps facing north, and with a white parasol held over him, he surveyed each quarter and uttered the words of the leader of the herd. I am the highest in the world. I am the best in the world. I am foremost in the world. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being for me. This, too, I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. When the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendor of the gods, appeared in the world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas. In this generation, with its recluses and Brahmins, with its princes and its people, and even in those abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and the sun, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail, there too a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendor of the gods, appeared, and the beings reborn there perceived each other by that light. So indeed, sir, there are other beings reborn here. And this 10,000-fold world system shook and quaked and trembled, and there too a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendor of the gods, appeared. That when the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light, surpassing the splendor of the gods, appeared. This too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. That being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Here, Ananda, for the Tathagata, feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear. Remember this too, Ananda, as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. Venerable Sir, since for the Blessed One feelings are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear, perceptions are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear, thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they disappear, this too I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. That is what the Venerable Ananda said. The teacher approved, the bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Ananda's words. One of those out of left field suttas, but I find it quite... all these marvelous, astounding things. And what the Buddha chooses to emphasize is the feelings, perceptions, and thoughts as they arise, as they establish, as they cease. Because that's, you say, what's most important. And and these are... There's a, before I went to America, I met a woman who had nothing is quite as dramatic as this, but she had a dream or a vision of an old monk coming to her and saying that he was taking birth with her and that she'd need to, she'd be keeping the five precepts and when she's talking about it, she was sort of amazed that because she wasn't that great at keeping the precepts before, and then all of a sudden it was very natural to keep the precepts, and then she would give She would give Dhamma talks to her friends. many of these things are, you think, okay, it's wonderful and marvelous, but that's sort of some fable sort of passed on through the Buddha's time. But it was very interesting. She said, as the as the fetus matured, as it got more and more red, closer to birth, then she felt because there was this very clear connection with this being in her womb, and she said it started to decrease the strength of that and the power of it, not completely out of the realm of possibility.
And did her child indeed become a monk?
That I don't know. That's quite a while ago now, and I haven't followed up. I'm from time to time I do think about that, but it was this old monk who came to her and she.
Pat Roypi. Pat Roypi.
Pat Roypi. Yeah. So is he a 100-year-old monk?
So when I was invited to give a 2-minute Dhamma talk at 10 Downing Street for Visakha Puja, that was the that was my theme.
Good theme.
2 minutes was really unfair. It's cruel and unusual punishment. It's barely halfway through an inhalation. It was the first Dhamma talk at 10 Downing Street.
10 Downing Street. Well, 2 minutes is a great start then. Were there other religious people giving talks?
I was the only one giving a talk. It was for Visakha. It was the first time Visakha Puja was held. There was different Buddhist lineages.
Right.
And they asked, I was invited to give a little Dhamma talk. It was curious. It was for Visakha Puja, and there was murmurings that Rishi Sunak, who was the Prime Minister at the time, was going to be there. But then there was an apology that one of his assistants was going to be there instead, and the Minister for Religion and Faith and Community was leading the event, Baroness something or other. But it was the day that Rishi Sunak announced the general election. So we realized he was actually talking to King Charles while we were having our Vesak at 10 Downing Street. So he wasn't there for that. When we came out of the sort of famous front door, all these reporters and cameras photographers there. And usually, as Buddhists wearing robes and such like, we're the subject of people's attention. But we all sort of came out, have our picture taken, and there was a sort of not paying attention to us. They thought, it was pouring with rain. I thought, all these reporters are out in the rain. They've got their cameras. They've got their kind of video gear, and they're not taking any pictures of us. Strange. So anyway, we just had our pictures taken. Then we left, and then the reporters were still waiting there. This is really weird. And then we found out that that was the day that Rishi Sunak announced the election. So they had heard rumors that was going to be the announcement. So they were there for Rishi Sunak. So later that afternoon, he was out in the rain making his announcement outside that famous front door. So it was very auspicious. I thought of that about 20 seconds before I started speaking as a theme.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, because it was, I forget the name of the minister, Baroness something or other, who was
Wasi. Baroness Wasi.
No, it wasn't her that day. It was a Caucasian baroness, and she was sort of hosting the event, and it was some comments that she had made that made me want to bring the sort of the presence of meditation and mindfulness practices in the UK, and the celebration of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and final passing away. And it just occurred to me, literally, like 20, 30 seconds before I was up to the podium, oh, that would be a really good theme. Yeah. And so because exactly as Lumpur was saying, it's like, yeah, this is all very well, these miraculous things, walking and talking as soon as you're born. Okay, but the real miracle is we can watch our minds. That's a miracle that is really useful. And it was only afterwards I thought maybe that the Baroness thought I was competing with her Christian birth miracles. Yeah. Okay, your guy was the son of God, but I was walked and talked as soon as he was born. So I wasn't trying to compete, but I she was a little bit standoffish afterwards. So. It was a very sweet occasion. And they were very, very good hosts. Very good hosts. It was all non-alcoholic refreshments.
Okay, good for them.
She was good for them.
They did their homework.
They did. Which was not the case at the Buddhist Society, they say. I realize we're being recorded, but that was the case. They were sort of side by side in the same week.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
Okay.
So.
And thus has it always been.
The copy of the Majjhima Nikaya that I inherited from Lumpur Sumedho when I came here, and he'd moved out of his kuti and I moved in. That passage is, he had it highlighted into purple and yellow highlighter in his copy of the Majjhima. And there's very few marks on any of the pages, but that particular paragraph right at the end, you know,
this is important.
This is the real miracle, is that we can watch our minds. So it's extremely significant for Lumpur Sumedho as well.
Okay, we'll continue on. Okay. One who is either inclined to Nibbana or has already attained some realization tends not to be drawn into the world and its complications. The protection provided by this composure is not strained or forced, but instead has become an innate characteristic within the heart. And then the quote that I use is from the Majjhima 122, which is the Maha Sunyata Sutta, the greater discourse on emptiness. Indeed, Ananda, it is not possible that a bhikkhu who delights in company, takes delight in company, and devotes himself to delight in company, who delights in society, takes delight in society, and rejoices in society, will ever enter upon and abide in either the deliverance of mind that is temporary and delectable, or in the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. But it can be expected that when a bhikkhu lives alone, withdrawn from society, he will enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind that is temporary and delectable, or in the deliverance of mind that is perpetual and unshakable. However, Ananda, there is this abiding discovered by the Tathagata. To enter and abide in voidness or emptiness, sunyata, internally by giving no attention to all signs. If, while the Tathagata is abiding thus, he is visited by bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, by men or women lay followers, by kings or king's ministers, by other sectarians or the disciples, then with a mind leaning to seclusion, tending and inclining to seclusion, withdrawn, delighting in renunciation, and altogether done with things that are the basis for taints, he invariably talks to them in a way concerned with dismissing them. Therefore, Ananda, if a bhikkhu should wish,
May I enter upon and abide in voidness internally, or in sunyata internally, he should steady his mind internally, quiet it, bring it to singleness, concentrate it. So this sense of emptiness or sunyata is a composure that is, say, it's a part of developing and recognizing the empty nature of both the internal world and the external world, and that's it's a part of practice or a way of using it, holding it as a practice. But then it's also a fruit of the practice. And although these qualities may seem to resemble aloofness or coldness, the opposite is true. And since, because it's sort of saying that, because that when the Buddha is sort of saying, leaning to seclusion, inclining to seclusion, withdrawn, delighting renunciation, but the fact is he's doing that while he's receiving people, teaching, engaging, and with whoever is got an interest or an inclination themselves toward the Dhamma. And that, although these qualities may seem to resemble aloofness or coldness, the opposite is true. The Buddha drew countless beings to his presence because of his inspiring demeanor. Throughout the history of Buddhist countries, enlightened followers of the Buddha have always been a source of encouragement, and the many folk have wanted to draw close to them because of the warmth of their example. Indeed, the Buddha praises those who have lived for the well-being of others. And it continues on.
It's very notable that the Buddha is always inclining towards drawing things to a close. He's not just, he's happy to be available, to engage, but he's not looking to just sort of pass time and chit-chat and just keep it going just for the sake of getting a buzz or the banter.
Because he can't think of anything else to do.
Yeah, there's that sort of beautiful way of expressing it, always inclining to, okay, time to wrap this up. Oh, one more thing. Oh, okay. Again, that like the touch of Suchiloma being unpleasant. It's like the inclining away from association, from engagement, and just not sort of looking for contact or looking for just the company for that sense of affirmation or warmth or just that human companionship. And I think it's a sign of great spiritual maturity. Many people just don't like to be alone. I don't know about in other countries. This in the UK, people have the radio on all the time just for company, and quite happy. Oh yeah, it keeps me company. Radio 4 or Radio 2. Just, and it's like, well, notice that. Why do you feel incomplete or alone? Why do you need to have that company? And so it's a small statement, but it carries a very meaningful social message.
Yeah, and one of the great examples, I mean, of course, Lopa Cha was a great example, but one of the things that one of the people who was very struck by was when the years and the times that I traveled with Lopa Panyananda, who is this very, very famous teacher from Thailand, and he early years of Chittorst and Amaravati, and for many years he came here to help support the establishing of the Sangha and going to some of the other branch monasteries as well, Australia, New Zealand, because he was concerned that with Lopa Cha being ill, that people wouldn't know about what was happening in the West. And he was somebody who was his Dhamma talks on Sunday were that usually, I don't know, probably at least 1,000 people show up for the Dhamma talk on Sunday, and the hall would be full, the whole area around would be full, and he would give the talk before the meal, and by the end of the meal, this is in the days of cassette tapes, the talk would be reproduced and tapes would be available for people to take back and distribute amongst various other people. He probably had on a weekly basis would be on television and radio giving Dhamma talks. He would travel around the country giving Dhamma talks. And so, yeah, he knew how to talk. But when he wasn't, it was always like traveling with him. If there wasn't something to say, he was happy just being by himself and sitting quietly. Or even when, say, like coming to, especially coming to the West where, he's definitely used to being center of attention, but then because of his, he knew some English, but it wasn't comfortable or fluent in it. And so he would quite happily just sit there quietly and let everything happen around him. It was really quite a wonderful example because there just wasn't a sense of self that was sort of needed to be inserted, but that happy to dwell in just being empty. It was really we see that dwelling in seclusion and sort of like, oh, somehow I've got to get away from everybody because they're an impingement on my well-being. But it's more like, no, it's an internal quality that is inclining away from that, having to insert oneself into the present moment, wherever that moment is.
Is a hand.
Very short comment. I'm struck that very often in the sutras that Buddha himself does not speak, you know, that there's, you know, a question arises and somebody else answers it, and at the end he just says, yes, that is how it is. And and he's just sitting and he doesn't even speak. It's almost as if he prefers to be quiet.
You get these different flavors as you go. You get more and more familiar with the suttas and the kind of the personality of the Buddha, and you realize, okay, there was, yeah, somebody was really there.
He was in samadhi. It's that he would be resting in samadhi and listening.
Mm-hmm.
Samadhi, he would be, yeah.